Ready for another great show, ladies and gentlemen. It's the John Carlson Program. 5 minutes after 6 o'clock, the radio program of record underway and ready to go this 21st day of March. Thanks for the month of March is 2/3 over. What? Anyway, go ahead and give us a shout on our new phone numbers if you would like. 206. Let's see. 644-6006.
Oh, he got it.
Trying to do it from memory, which wasn't going to be a problem until I actually started talking.
Yeah, we're working on bids with companies to create a fun phone number that's easy to remember here, just like the competition going on here with Memorial Stadium here. To
I think 421-JOHN sounds just perfect
ooh,
to me.
Ooh.
Look at you.
That could work.
Woo. Anyway, for right now, it's not 421-JOHN. It's 206.
Going to wake somebody up and
644-6006.
Interrupt their morning.
All right. There is so much stuff going on today, but I want to start local, see if we can find out a little bit more about this awful shooting yesterday. Apparently, sheriff's deputies showing up at an apartment building to serve an eviction notice. A deputy shot and wounded. The bullet missed his vest. And hit his upper torso. Anyway, Channel 5 reporter Kristen Goodwillie spoke to Megan Black, who is serving as the spokesperson, used to be a King TV reporter, for this investigation.
According to King County's Independent Force Investigation Team, or IFIT, things escalated quickly after detectives arrived.
When they initially made contact at the residence, there was gunfire that was exchanged.
It's unclear who fired first, but a deputy was struck and critically injured. Black says law enforcement believes that the renter and two uninjured deputies exchanged gunfire. Then the renter barricaded themselves in the apartment.
The subject regressed back into the residence at the time. When officers were able to make entry into the residence, they found the individual deceased.
Okay, still not clear whether the deputies firing back at the gunman or the, I guess, the gun person, you'll learn more here in a moment, was the cause of that person's death or whether that person took their own life. Anyway, here's Como 4's Lin-Ann Nguyen.
Investigators say the eviction process has been going on since January. We spoke with a friend of the person being evicted who didn't want to be identified, but shared the person identified as a transgender female.
Out of desperation, barricaded themselves in their apartment because they owed $13,000 in back rent and had exhausted all legal options and had exhausted all pandemic relief funds and any funds provided by local nonprofits.
The friend says the situation had deteriorated to the point she wasn't sleeping and constantly in fear of being evicted.
They were committed to helping others, but it seems like they couldn't help themselves.
Okay. So shoot a deputy. I cannot wait to hear more news about this. In the meantime, your prayers for the deputy, who I believe, Phil, is out of surgery, but still in critical condition.
Yeah, there was surgery yesterday. Seems to be in stable condition right now, but critical.
So stable, but critical. Again, so unnecessary. And by the way, they're $13,000 behind on their rent after they got PPP funds, after they got pandemic relief, after they got assistance from nonprofit groups.
Yeah.
So, you know, who knows what on earth possessed them to pick up a gun and fire at another human being.
John, it's just ironic, too. I'm trying to remember the listener who checked in with us a few times there in Ballard near the Fred Meyer with all the business and activity going on there. This is just a few blocks north of Fred Meyer.
Yeah, this was off Northwest 8th Ave,
right,
at 54th, so a block south of Market. There's so many sad elements to
this. Well, yeah, it was last week they had the Jack in the Box that used to be there. It's been shut down. Yeah. And that's where the fire up on the rooftop.
That's maybe about five blocks away, give or take.
So again, this is part and parcel of what I've been talking about for a long time. This is what happens in a community, in a society, when hard drugs are not only legalized, but are destigmatized, and you have a hard drug culture.
Well, and I think as it relates to this eviction process, I think that's going to put the, eviction enablers like Shama Sawant with the city council under a microscope. I mean, were they enabling this individual in Ballard to the point where person felt like they were entitled? I'm entitled to stay here. You can't evict me. You can't kick me out. I don't have an obligation to either work out an arrangement for rent with a landlord. I mean, this is a two-way street here. This is not a one-way street when it comes to being a tenant in an apartment or a building.
So hopefully this morning we'll have even more information, but the most important information from my vantage point is that this deputy has survived the shooting, is out of surgery, and is in stable, though critical, condition. So we pray for that deputy's continued recovery. It's the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Boy, do we have a lot of stuff we want to get into. Just yesterday, I played a clip from the famous Shark Tank television show investor, Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful, telling a CNN morning show why he does not invest in blue states. He does not invest in companies, will not locate a company in California or in New York or in New Jersey or in Massachusetts. And I said, makes you wonder how far back in the pipeline Washington State is, given our tax and regulatory policies. Well, here we have a story that we'll play a little later on, where a silicon smelter that was once proposed for the northeast Washington town of Newport, there on the Ponderay River, is now going to be relocated. $150 million facility is now going to be built in Tennessee on the banks of the Mississippi River. It just took too long in rural eastern Washington to get clearance. We'll have more details for you. By the way, whenever you think about the economy doing really well, you usually think about, well, King County, because, you know, cities with lots of millionaires and billionaires and bajillionaires are mostly located here in King County. However, King County is actually growing at a slower pace than Washington State. You know what county is outpacing all of them? Kitsap County, over on the peninsula. And it's not even a close call. The King County growth rate is 2.3%. Wages grew between 2021 and 2022. Wages grew in King County over that 1 year period, 2.3%. It's about 1/3 the inflation rate. Inflation was between 6% and 7%. So King County wages lost track with inflation. Washington State as a whole grew 5.2%. Again, a little bit less than inflation. And by the way, less than the national wage increase between 2021 and 2022. The national wage increase was 6.7%. Washington's was 5.2%. King County's was just 2.3%. But Kitsap County, 12.7%. Kitsap County over on the peninsula had the second fastest growing wages of any county in America. First place was Midland County, Texas, almost 14%. Then comes Kitsap County, Washington, 12.7%. Then comes Prince William County, Virginia, 12.6%, the periphery of Washington, D.C. They benefit a lot from wealthy lobbyists, contractors, etc., who live in Prince William. And then, boy, you folks in Kansas are going to be correcting my pronunciation on this, I'm sure. It's Wyandotte.
That sounds about right.
Wyandotte County, Kansas, 12.4%. But again, kudos to you folks in Kitsap.
I thought you were going to get to Olathe in Kansas.
No, they're not on the list. Thank goodness they didn't make...
That's one that crosses up a lot of people.
They didn't make the top 10. Most of the places that made the top 10, with the exception of Kitsap County, Washington, and Yolo, California, and Dakota, Minnesota, the other seven counties in the top 10, all Republican states, all red states. But Kitsap County, again, the second county in America for fastest wage growth between 21 and 22. Congratulations, Kitsap County. It's a busy morning on the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. The latest on whether Donald Trump is going to be arrested and charged with a crime in a city where the woke liberal activist prosecutor is famous for downgrading felonies to misdemeanor status. He is trying to elevate the accusations against Donald Trump from misdemeanor status to felony status, going the other way. And I told you yesterday why the case against Trump is just silly. It's borderline frivolous. But it gets them a headline, and it hasn't happened yet. We'll give you the latest on whether Donald Trump is facing arrest or not. Plus, earlier this week, we told you that a clean kitchen is a sign of racism. Guess what else is now a sign of racism? Drinking coffee.
Would you stop?
It's got to be. It's got to be colonial. Colonial at a minimum. If it's not out now, racist. Right?
I'll explain. What do I tell you about the radical left? They politicize everything in life, from having a orderly refrigerator and a well organized pantry to whether you drink coffee or not. Anyway, more on that. Straight ahead, Philip J., who, thank goodness, does not sing karaoke, at least not on the air.
Oh, I like to croon some Sinatra tunes from time to time, but I've not tried Bob
Dylan.
Oh,
I'm sure you sound just like him. Anyway.
You know I do.
What's going on with the Twitter 20?
Yes, Twitter 20, sponsored by the Muckleshoot Casino. All roads lead to Muckleshoot. The United Nations, they had another one of their climate reports that popped out, and the Associated Press posted a story that I saw on social media. And the Associated Press explanation goes along like this. A top United Nations panel of scientists says there is still a chance to prevent the worst of climate change harms, but doing so requires quickly slashing carbon pollution and fossil fuel use by nearly two-thirds by the year 2035. I liked how they put that. There's still a chance if you guys want to do this, there's still a chance. So the UN has, had this, I think, ongoing track record of trying to kick out semi-urgent claims that we got to do something, that sort of a thing. And then somebody posted a screen grab, and I don't know if the screen grab is verified or not, but it is something dated June 30th, 1989. And 1989, the prediction is a senior UN environmental official says entire nations could be wiped off the face of the earth by rising sea levels if the global warming trend is not reversed by the year 2000. So, I mean, a possible red flag there that it seems a little too cute to believe 1989. The claim was 2000 were going to be wiped off the map.
But I tell you what, Phil, I've got a new assignment for you.
Hit me.
It's no longer what predictions did the global warming alarmists make 30 years ago or 20 years ago or 10 years ago that turned out to be bogus, silly nonsense.
Yeah.
Instead, see if you can find anywhere a prediction that global warming alarmists, climate change crusaders made.
The UN.
That was actually true.
To be accurate.
That actually came out to be accurate.
Yeah. You bet. That's a fine question.
That's going to be a much more difficult job than finding a prediction they made that was nonsensical.
One more quickie here. A CNN senior reporter, senior national correspondent, Kyung Law, based out of Los Angeles, posted about a trip to San Francisco with another CNN senior producer at the LA Bureau. And they posted, got robbed again. We were at City Hall, San Francisco, to do an interview for at CNN. Had security to watch our rental car plus crew car. Thieves did this in under 4 seconds. Smashed out a back window. Security stopped the jerks from stealing other bags. But seriously, this is ridiculous, says the reporter.
Donald Trump is facing arrest, or is he? They keep going back and forth on whether or when it's going to happen. Donald Trump is getting out in front of it. He has been predicting loudly and constantly that he was going to be arrested today, calling on his supporters to protest. A lot of Trump allies are saying, no, 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 don't protest. They don't want anything getting out of hand that gives the media the excuse to say, you see, Donald Trump's just fomenting violence again. There he goes. January 6th wasn't enough. Now he's trying to get the people to attack the judicial system, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, don't give him that opportunity. I explained yesterday why this is all so bogus. And I think what it gets down to is, again, this particular prosecutor, Alvin Bragg, you know, progressive, activist, partisan Democrat, is famous for trying to convert felony crimes into misdemeanors so he can reduce the sentences for offenders or just dismiss charges. He's famous for this. This is one of the reasons why New York now has a crime problem after not having a crime problem for a long, long time. Again, he's famous for trying to convert felonies into misdemeanors. Now he's trying to do the opposite for one person in one instance, Donald Trump, trying to transform what might be a misdemeanor, by the way, might be a misdemeanor, into a felony. That tells you everything you need to know, that office is not about justice. It's not about upholding the rule of law. It's not about upholding the integrity of the criminal justice system. It's all about using the criminal justice system to pursue political ends. Okay, so with that in mind, Ron DeSantis was giving a press conference, holding a press conference, and a local reporter asked him what he thought about the charges against Donald Trump and whether his office would be cooperating with New York authorities, if necessary, to send Trump from Florida, where he now lives and makes his home at Mar-a-Lago, back to Manhattan, where he used to live. Anyway, here is how Ron DeSantis handled the question.
The Manhattan district attorney is a Soros-funded prosecutor. And so he, like other Soros-funded prosecutors, they weaponize their office to impose a political agenda on society at the expense of the rule of law and public safety. He has downgraded over 50% of the felonies to misdemeanors. He says he doesn't want to even have jail time for the vast, vast majority of crimes. And what we've seen in Manhattan is we've seen the crime rate go up, and we've seen citizens become less safe. And so you're talking about this situation with, and look, I don't know what goes into paying hush money to a porn star to secure silence over some type of alleged affair. I can't speak to that. But what I can speak to is that if you have a prosecutor who is ignoring crimes happening every single day in his jurisdiction, and he chooses to go back many, many years ago to try to use something about porn star hush money payments, you know, that's an example of pursuing a political agenda and weaponizing the office. And I think that that's fundamentally wrong.
Okay, I think that Ron DeSantis handled that question flawlessly. And if you think different, or if you simply want to chime in, go ahead, give us a call at 206-644-6006. Again, that's 206-644-6006. Or if you want, if you've got the KVI app on your phone and you can get it in lickety-split, and of course it's free, just scroll down to the bottom and call the station or send a text or a voicemail message, and we'll get it. And yes, we'll play it. Got to watch your language, but we'll play it. Okay. Just to recap here. The Federal Justice Department looked into this matter almost 5 years ago. Okay. This involves hush money allegedly paid in 2016 for a fling that Donald Trump allegedly had, probably had, in 2013. In 2018 and 2019, the Department of Justice looked into this matter and declined to press charges. Then the New York prosecutor, his name is Cyrus Vance. Cyrus Vance's father was Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State. He is a Democrat. He looked at this issue. Did Donald Trump commit a crime when he allegedly paid hush money to porn star Stormy Daniels? No charges. His office said, no, we've investigated it exhaustively. There's no crime that we are going to charge him with. Then they changed prosecutors, and in comes Alvin Bragg, and he was briefed on the issue, and he said no. Okay, so the prosecutor who is now saying yes, a year ago said no. And because of a pressure campaign, he has flipped and is now pursuing legal charges against Trump. I think that Ron DeSantis handled this very well. And the reason why I say that is that, you know, DeSantis himself is a lawyer and a good one. And he said, legally speaking, this is so abusive. And let me tell you a little bit more about this prosecutor. And he lays out the sheer hypocrisy of someone who is famous for downgrading criminal charges and here is trying to dramatically escalate criminal charges on a matter that his predecessor said didn't deserve criminal charges in the first place. So DeSantis did a very good job of pointing out just what an awful prosecutor Alvin Bragg is and how he's not really a prosecutor. He's a political activist who won the office. And secondly, he doesn't exonerate Donald Trump's behavior, which clearly annoys Donald Trump. But he said, you know, I'm not going to speak about the whole issue of hush money to porn stars, separate matter. And it is a separate matter. It is legal to pay hush money and have an NDA, non-disclosure agreement. There are a number of reasons why people would pay hush money, whether it is because of a personal indiscretion like Donald Trump's accused of, or maybe a business indiscretion. You know, you had a bankruptcy or something like that. Or you parted company on embarrassing terms from your previous employer. And you make an arrangement that as you move forward with your life, you know, you'll settle the dispute and there will be no disclosure about anything else. Those agreements can be legal. Sometimes they can be illegal, but they are, for the most part, legal. What they're trying to say is if he did it for the political campaign, then that makes it illegal. Well, how do you prove it was for the political campaign? What if he just didn't want his wife to know? Is that sensible that a man who allegedly cheated on his wife with a porn star may not want his wife to know? So he makes an arrangement with her not to disclose it, and he gives her money, and she signs an agreement, I won't disclose it? So they can't prove, they cannot prove that this had anything to do with the campaign. You conclude that it did, but you can't prove it. So that's where they are. Anyway, I thought Ron DeSantis handled this very well. It didn't exonerate Trump for his behavior, but he excoriated the prosecutor in New York for his behavior, as he should. Talk about an abuse of office. You're listening to The Commute with Carlson. Lars Larson right around the corner on Talk Radio 570 KVI. My friend Lars Larson, our noon to three host. Good morning, Lars. How are you?
I'm doing very well, John. What's on your mind today?
Well, I'm looking, we were just discussing how Ron DeSantis responded, and I think you've heard it, and you may have played it during part of your show that I may have missed yesterday. His response to the charges against Donald Trump, and he went right at the prosecutor, Alvin Bragg, he should have, because here's a guy who's famous for trying to convert felonies into misdemeanors. Now, for the first time, apparently, for the first time since taking office, he's trying to convert a misdemeanor into a felony.
I thought the best meme I saw yesterday was that Alvin Bragg had him with two test tubes doing gain of function by turning a misdemeanor into a felony. And with Alvin Bragg as the scientist, this is where I know that people look at this and they say, okay, it's a big circus. It's not at my level. The problem is, this kind of nonsense does hurt people, because if you think that they're not politicizing the judicial system below the levels of the FBI and Donald Trump and, you know, top level, political folks, you're wrong. It's happening in local communities as well. And I've seen it where, you know, Antifa goes out and burns down part of the town. No, nothing happened.
Right.
A conservative pulls a pistol and points it at somebody who's threatening them. In fact, a group of people, he gets convicted of 12 felonies. And that's just an ordinary person who's finding out if you're on the wrong side politically of the prosecutor will do great damage to you. And
right.
If you're on the right side, your crimes may be ignored.
Right.
And that's just dead wrong.
And speaking of crime, again, don't miss Lars Larson every day of the work week. every day of the work week from noon to 3. Back we are, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Time for hour number 2 of the radio program of record. Thank you very much for letting me be part of your listening morning. Yesterday, we played a wonderful tape, a little video vignette from the CNN morning show, which hardly anyone watches, so I know you haven't heard it. And the show was Kevin O'Leary, featured Kevin O'Leary, who's famous on Shark Tank, for explaining why he was no longer locating companies in blue states. He said basically they're uninvestable. We have a very intriguing update to that clip on CNN. But before I tell you what the update is, let's roll again with what Kevin O'Leary was telling Poppy Harlow and Don Lemon and Caitlin Collins on yesterday's CNN, or on the CNN morning show late last week.
I don't put companies here in New York anymore, or in Massachusetts, or in New Jersey, or in California. Those states are uninvestable. The policy here is insane. The taxes are too high. We put them in Fargo, North Dakota, because 40% of the people work elsewhere, including Boston. So I was, you know, a bit of a debate with Elizabeth Warren about this, but I say, look, Senator, we've got to move the companies out of your state because you're not investable anymore. You're punishing people if they're successful. You overtax them. You hit them with a super tax. New Jersey, what a mess. New York, uninvestable.
Wait, California. Why is New York uninvestable?
Try and do a project in New York. Try and build a data.
Yeah, I'm asking, Don's point, is it beyond the taxes?
Oh, the regulatory environment is punitive. I had a project in upstate New York behind the grid in Niagara Falls for electricity, a global data center we were building. Eventually, it got so bad with the politicians in the local region and the state policy, we moved it to Norway and all the jobs. Wow. Norway has it now. Thousands of jobs coming out of that. I mean, that's New York, uninvestable. Sorry, don't shoot the messenger, just telling you the way it is.
Okay. And you'll note the states he mentioned, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, California, all deep blue states. Kind of like Washington. And it so happens that we have an update to the story that suggests that Kevin O'Leary probably won't be in any hurry to locate any businesses here in Washington State either. The largest silicon metal plant outside of China was not only going to be built here in the United States of America, it was going to be built here in Washington State. Not only built in Washington State, but built in Eastern Washington. So the whole issue about building a silicon smelter, you know, near a population center is a non-issue. It was going to be built on the banks of the Pendere River. And everything appeared to be okay. Pendere County, again, we're talking about northeast Washington. So picture Washington State. This is, you go to eastern Washington, then you keep going up north toward the Canadian border. Newport is a charming town, but they could use the jobs. Okay, the high-tech boom that came to Washington has not really hit eastern Washington, except when it comes to the price of homes, because a lot of wealthy techies and others in western Washington now have weekend places, or they work from home in eastern Washington. So the price of housing has gone up a whole lot. That aside, this smelter was a $150 million project. It would have employed 140 people, which, again, in a town like Newport, would have gotten noticed, would have mattered. They pulled the project and they've relocated it to not the banks of the Ponderay River, but the banks of the Mississippi River in Tennessee. The major obstacle? Excessive regulation, entanglements, permit delays, and regulatory obstacles. According to a spokesman for the project, the number one obstacle was Washington not being able to, the officials in Ponderay County not being able to get the property rezoned for industrial use after promising that it could be done. In Tennessee, they said, what can we do to make this happen? In Ponderay County, they said, well, we need to update our comprehensive plan. For some reason, it took forever to do that. And as a consequence, again, the smelter went away. Quote, when we bought the land south of Newport from the Ponderay Public Utility District, it was earmarked by the Public Utility District for a gas turbine, so we thought it would be fine for us. But Greg Snow, that again, that's a spokesman for the silicon metal project, metal plant. But Greg Snow, who's the community development director for Ponderay County, said, well, the comp plan took a long time and there was a lot of work to do by a consultant that we hired in the planning commission. And that, you know, without that conditional use application process, we're not going to be able to get this done in time. And they didn't. And so the company said, you know what? We're gone. We're out of here. Washington is famous for this. Here's the biggest difference between government and business. The biggest difference between government and business is that to a government, time is not money. So you'll notice that it often takes longer to build a road, not just a new road in a new place, but just expanding an existing road. It takes longer to do that than it did 50 or 60 years ago, despite all of the advances that we've made in technology. It took less time to build a road in a new location or build a bridge in a new location than it takes to add a lane or two to an existing highway. It shouldn't. But over the years, layer after layer after layer of bureaucracy and process at all levels of government, local, federal, state, county, have made it a real burden that has kept a lot of small businesses out of entire industries. Let me give you one quick example. The 520 floating bridge. The 520 floating bridge was constructed originally back in 1963. I forget what the actual price for it was, but I do know this. They started with a 25-cent toll. Then they lowered it to 15 cents. And they had paid for the bridge by 1979. So it took 16 years worth of tolls, and then the bridge was paid for. And the tolls came off. The toll booths went away. The current expansion of 520, again, not the not building the bridge itself, just expanding 520, costs about $5 billion. The toll on it averages closer to $3, sometimes as much as $5 or $6. The tolls will never come off because they will only account for a portion of what it will cost to build out the 520 bridge. The 520 floating bridge expansion costs more than 40 times what it costs to build it in the first place. Not twice as much, not three times as much, not 10 times as much. It costs 40 times more to expand the 520 floating bridge than it cost to build it. This is just a perfect example of how out of control costs and process and regulation and delays are in building anything of significance. And like I said, when it comes to private builders trying to put up, you know, silicon metal plant, the largest outside of China here in the United States, here in Washington State, eventually, even in eastern Washington, rural eastern Washington, the regulatory environment was so suffocating that the company said, you know what, forget it. We'll just do this in Tennessee. It's a lesson there. It's 18 and a half minutes after 7 o'clock. The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Philip J. Wright around the corner. The Twitter 20. Also, yesterday we told you that progressives now believe that keeping a clean kitchen with an orderly spice rack and pantry is a sign of racism. Today, it's not just a clean kitchen that's racist. It's drinking a cup of coffee. I'd like bright blue skies, all right?
Give it a few hours. Give it a few hours, John. We'll get there.
Philip J., it's 24 minutes after 7 o'clock, and you've been scouring social media for the Twitter 20.
There's been some scrubbing going on. Mark has been reporting on the Seattle City School District and City of Seattle effort to try and refurb Memorial Stadium there in the shadow of the Space Needle for a sports facility. Did you hear about what the state legislature in Olympia is doing to help a minor league baseball stadium in Everett? According to the Everett Herald and their handle at Everett Herald, state lawmakers are looking to steer millions of dollars, about $7.4 million that's been allocated by the Democrats running the legislature at Olympia, to Everett to help it build a new ballpark for the Everett Aqua Sox.
What's wrong with the existing ballpark?
I don't know. I mean, the location's fairly good. It's not too far off I-5 and all that, but apparently there's going to be some sort of a push for a new facility for the Aqua Sox, either that or renovating what they've got. So And then I've been the one-man Michaela Schifrin ski update machine. Over the weekend, she won another women's event. So that's, I think, 88 now, passing Ingemar Stenmark, and she won the giant slalom in Soldu.
So she's...
That's the race that ends the season.
So she is the best all-time women's skier and arguably the best all-time American skier.
Yeah, for sure, American, yeah.
And now you're making a play that she's the best all-time skier?
I think so, yeah. I think the numbers would bear that out.
That should get... You know what? That should get more attention.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a pretty incredible career, and she's probably still got a couple of years to keep going to add to her record-setting achievements. TheHill.com has this story about the White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, and other reporters pushing back on a disruptive journalist at White House press briefings. And Sean Spicer, who was the press secretary for Donald Trump at the beginning of his administration, picked up on this story that TheHill.com posted, and he wrote, "For 4 years, the White House press corps were silent as clowns like CNN's Jim Acosta and Playboy's reporter Brian Karem disrupted press briefings for the Trump administration, and now they are champions of decorum and manners that reporters are doing this during the Biden administration." And so he's kind of calling out this disconnect, and as we like to say, if it weren't for double standards, what would people on the political left have? They'd have no standards.
Well, the people in Lakewood have standards, and we are going to tell you what those standards are. Did you have another one real quick, Philip J?
It's an on this date in history, but why don't I save it? It has to do with the Red Scare after World War II and President Harry Truman, an executive order that he issued. But I'll save it for next hour with Socialists on Social Media. Not that Harry Truman's a socialist. I'm just going to fit it into what's going on today.
The story in my interview with Jonathan Cho, great citizen journalist. You can see his work at discovery.org or check it out on Twitter. About what he calls the sweep of the year. They're finally cleaning up this massive homeless encampment the size of two football fields that was on land along the west side of the Duwamish River, 2nd Avenue and Michigan Street. Illegal homeless drug camp on land that is jointly owned by the state and the city of Seattle's Department of Transportation. So, of course, nobody can figure out who's responsible for cleaning it up. Finally, it happened yesterday. Jeremy Harris from Como 4 was on the scene, spoke to a man who had been living at this encampment, which, again, like all of them, is illegal. You don't have the right to do that. You could be told to leave. And until just recently, these people weren't.
Crews began to dismantle a homeless encampment that had taken over the banks of the Duwamish Waterway under the First Avenue Bridge.
By the way, where were the environmentalists? Where were the environmentalists? Here they are right along the banks of a river. And I don't need to tell you about the filth and the biohazards and the needles and the other garbage. And there's no environmentalist demanding that at the very least these guys be set back a couple hundred feet from any water source? Is there a reason why Seattle environmentalists once again... We're just quiet about all this, as they are quiet when it comes to the West Point sewage treatment facility leaking, discharging sewage into Puget Sound because it's run by a environmental ally, King County Executive Dow Constantine. Anyway, let's continue.
The cops are down here all the time.
Brian Tiedemann was staying at the encampment.
This is, an an area where people could come and live the way they want to.
But even he admits things here were out of control, with drug use, fires, stolen cars, and violence.
This is the way people live. It's just trash everywhere. In order to take the trash, and people just don't care. They get to a point in their life where they're so low, they decide, you know, what else can I do?
What you can do is try and get your life together and get out of drug culture. Try and escape drug culture. It's hard. It's not easy, but things won't get better until you do. Again, this is how homeless drug addicts live when they can live the way they want to live. There is filth. There is crime. There is violence. Pretty much anywhere that it's allowed. And here it's allowed in way too many places. Another homeless resident there spoke to Jeremy Harris. The man's name is Jose. Got to be careful here, you know, because he speaks with an accent. So listen carefully as he tells Como 4 about the drug use going on.
Girls. Every day, the drugs.
I talked to Jose, who told me he lived here for months, but now is moving into an apartment. What was it like living in an encampment like this?
No good.
Outreach teams tell Como they found housing for 30 people and that they hope this work now is a positive step forward for the neighborhood and for the people who were staying here. You never want to come back here?
No. No.
Can't say that I blame him. Jeremy also spoke with a couple of women who are business owners. The businesses are near this illegal homeless camp that they did nothing about for years before finally getting serious about cleaning it up this week.
Helene Scavarill owns a shop nearby.
It's at least 2 years that I know of.
She says the encampment was a source of constant worry.
We've been told, oh, it's going to get cleaned up. We're going to get that out of here, and it's actually happening.
People try and open the door, see if it's unlocked. We've had a couple break-ins.
Nikki Kreveling works within a block of the camp, and she says she's also relieved to see work finally start.
We've heard from customers say that they're not comfortable coming down to our building.
Well, of course not. And it doesn't sound like the owner's very comfortable being there either. That is supposed to matter. What law-abiding people care about is supposed to matter. What crime-committing drug addicts think does not matter. Because they are driving the quality of life downward because of illegal behavior. So, you know, if they want treatment, fine. If they don't want treatment, pick up your stuff and leave, because you can't live like that here. That's actually, they say, where's your compassion? That actually is compassionate. If everyone told homeless drug addicts, you can't set up shop here, you can't live like that here, eventually they would realize this is a dead end. I can't live like this. I've got to get my act together. But instead, the city of Seattle, its political establishment, has essentially shrugged its shoulders and allowed them to just do what they want to do. Now, some cities are watching what has happened to Seattle. You know, I was talking to a very prominent United States senator who was in town and was staying in downtown Seattle and was jogging in the area around 3rd and Columbia. And he had been to Seattle several times, but when I was talking to him, he asked me what a lot of people who come to Seattle now and then have asked me over the years. What the hell has happened to Seattle? And he said, you know, I'm jogging in the morning. downtown, and he describes the filth, and he describes the drug paraphernalia and the needles, and not one but two men who are going to the bathroom, people who are kind of staggering, roaming around, clearly coming down or getting high, coming down from a high or getting high, and he's just shaking his head. What? Why is this happening here? And I said, it's because it's been allowed to happen. These are all man-made decisions that resulted in the culture you see on the streets of downtown Seattle. Man-made decisions made this culture happen. The city of Lakewood, like a lot of cities, has looked at Seattle and said, you know, let's learn a lesson on their dime and not have to learn it on our own. So they have just passed a pair of new laws that will keep them from ending up like Seattle. Here's what they did.
The Lakewood City Council passed two ordinances related to public camping and illegal drug use. The first ordinance makes it illegal to use drugs like meth, heroin, or fentanyl in public. The other bans camping on public property. Each violation is a misdemeanor and punishable by 90 days in jail or a fine of $1,000. The new ordinances take effect in 30 days. The ordinance is similar to laws passed in other cities and intended to address an increase in public drug use.
Now you're probably thinking, yeah, John, it's just misdemeanor. I hear your point. But 30 days, 60 days, 90 days without a fix? That can be a very long period of time for a drug addict. And every time they are caught illegally camping, facing a penalty like that, again, they could do this in Seattle tomorrow. They won't because they're too stubborn. And as you know, stubborn starts to look stupid when you keep doing things that are not solving the problem. In Lakewood, they're making smart decisions. They're saying, you know, we're not going to give people the pamphlet when we catch them with fentanyl, for crying out loud. We're going to arrest them. If they're using drugs in public, we are going to arrest them instead of shrugging your shoulders and turning away like they do in Seattle. And so if you're using drugs or if you're illegally staying somewhere and you don't pick up your stuff and leave, again, you're subject to an arrest. We are not going to allow this contagion, this virus of hard drug culture to infest our city. Good for them. Good for them. It's a problem there and they're handling it. Jay Inslee's centerpiece for his legislative session, for the legislative session this year, was to borrow billions of dollars to accelerate more home construction. He needs voters' permission because he's going above and beyond the limit for how much Washington can borrow. There's a state constitution limit. So he wants to raise $4 billion over 6 years to build the housing. And you know what? He's got a strong Democratic House and Senate, and I don't think they're going to pass it. Mark Mullett, Democrat, Issaquah, Vice Chair of the Senate Ways and Means Committee, and one of the authors of the Capitol Budget, says that Inslee's plan of borrowing $4 billion outside the debt limit would mean that Washington would be spending more than 5% of its revenue to pay off its debts. Quote, I think the general thought process is if we're already having a hard time staying underneath that threshold, don't put more money on the credit card. Close quote. KVIC, blue skies over on the peninsula, but I don't see him over here on this side of Puget Sound.
Broken sky somewhere over the waters of Puget Sound.
Anyway, well,
yeah, clouds everywhere else.
Things are very bright and shiny in Kitsap County because, if you were listening earlier, you heard Kitsap County recorded the second highest wage growth between 2021 and 2022. Okay, in other words, last year, Kitsap County had the second highest wage growth of any county in the country. 12.7% in a year. There was only one other county that had 10%, and that was Whatcom County. The state average was 5.2, which is below the inflation rate. So if you are the average Washington State wage earner, you lost a little money. But if you live in King County, then you really did poorly. King County's average wage growth, again, average wage growth was less than half the state wage growth. It was just 2.3%. So Washington State had 5.2% growth. King County had 2.3% growth. And Kitsap County, 12.7%, second highest wage growth among any county in the United States. The only county that did better was Midland, Texas. So congrats. No wonder the sun is shining over there in Kitsap County, or at least most of it.
Oh, that explains on the ferry boat coming to Seattle, John, how many cars and trucks brand new I see on ferry boats. We have tons of listeners over there, as you know, ever since I moved here. I'm just impressed with everybody. Oh, Mark, I saw John and Phil. We listen to KVI. You know, maybe it's time we go across the water and get some of these people to be a part of the show, buy some advertising, do contest.
It's too late to move our studios. We just did. Anyway, as you know, at the first segment of the 8 o'clock hour, we talk to Randy Peppel from the best website on Washington State politics. Have you been checking it out? You ought to. ShiftWA. That's ShiftWA.org. ShiftWA.org. They are keying in on this radical bill that tramples all over parental rights. We've actually talked about Senate Bill 5599, but this bill is in play, which means we got to talk to Randy Peppel from ShiftWA to find out where it is and what people can do and when in Olympia. Randy Peppel, how are you this morning?
Doing well this morning, John, and thanks for having me on. And, you know, all this talk about budget increases, I mean, the state just announced that how many hundreds of millions more they're going to be bringing in tax revenue over the next 4 years. So all budgets are up in Washington State.
I love how some people have tried to frame it, though. Again, the state's revenue forecast came in yesterday. It's another increase, but some people had predicted that the money would increase even more. So they're trying to frame it as, yes, we've had a reduction in revenue. We're going to face having to cut budgets or raise taxes. It's all the more important. We have a wealth tax now.
It's any reason not to give money back to the taxpayer, John. Here's the fact to remember. This current budget, we're in a two-year budget that ends on June 30th. The state is spending 20.7% more in this budget than in the previous budget. It's the fifth straight budget under Jay Inslee that has increased
by
double digits.
Yeah. No, we've never had a governor. We've never had a governor who has spent so much money as Jay Inslee. More than Mike Lowry, more than the average Mike Lowry budget increase. And I know this will surprise some of you, but Dan Evans, when he was governor, this is back in the 60s and 70s when, you know, states were across the country were in a, you know, spending mode. Dan Evans had some huge budget increases during his time as governor. also had to weather the Boeing recession of the early 70s. But the bottom line is no one has spent nearly as much as Jay Inslee. And again, that's all he's had to do is addition. He hasn't had to do any subtraction. And despite these massive increases in revenue, at one point delivering a $10 billion surplus, which means that's how much you overpaid for government. They got more than they expected or more than they budgeted for. Not a single penny of it came back to taxpayers.
No. And, our budget is now over. We have a two-year budget. It's now over $65 billion is what they're projecting for the next budget. That is doubled in the 10 years that Jay Inslee has been in office. But, we'll have lots of time to talk about the
right.
budgets as they'll be coming out every day. They'll be voting on them starting on Wednesday for the next week as they try to move through the capital budget and then the operating budget. But you're right about House Bill, or rather
Senate Bill.
Senate Bill 5599. It's in the House tomorrow, John, at 1:30. It's in the Committee on Human Services. And, this is one that everybody should be calling in on and letting their legislators know, because this is the bill that allows the state to not inform parents when they have a minor in state custody who is seeking transgender conversion services. And it is just one of those bills that is so bad that the sponsor, Senator Marco Lias, had to lie about the bill in an op-ed to try to justify. You'll recall this. We talked about it last month. He wrote a Seattle Times op-ed, says, people are lying about my bill. The right-wing radio hosts are lying about my bill. They're saying that it changes the rule that the state must let you know about a runaway child. And all we're doing is creating some exceptions so that the state doesn't have to tell you.
No, that's what he said. The law that requires us to report the whereabouts of runaway children to parent remains in place. It is a lie to say that we're trying to repeal that law. That law remains in place, but we're putting in a few exceptions.
that completely gut the law. But anyway, so it's serious. I mean, it's not something to laugh about, but it is.
No, it is. It's terrible.
The State House tomorrow. And there are lots of groups that are out there that are talking about this, John. It's not just your listeners. They're not alone.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, when they held a committee hearing, they asked people to sign in and indicate if they wanted to testify, sign in and indicate whether you're for or against the bill. And I believe there were, a couple dozen people who wanted to support the bill, signed in to support the bill, and over 4,000 people wanted to testify against the bill.
Yes, it was over 98% of the people who registered an opinion on this bill in the Senate were opposed. They were not allowed the opportunity to convince the senators otherwise, because it was already lined up to pass. I mean, Senator Marco Lias had this bill ready to go from the start, and he's just been doing a smokescreen on it to try to make this the civil rights bill of our generation, when it's a parental rights bill, John.
You don't enhance civil rights when you trample on parents' rights. And this is the state, there is so much social media pressure on teens to, maybe they're confused, maybe they're curious, maybe they're, drifting. What if I'm of a different gender than the one I was born with? And it's encouraging them and pushing them. And here's the state of Washington now saying, and if you run away, we'll shield you from your parents. It's just evil. So, and if I'm not mistaken, does the state of Washington allow children under 18 to receive puberty blockers and, quote, gender-affirming care surgery?
This bill, and the way that it was explained by Senator Leas when it was up in the Senate, that was exactly the exemption that would allow a child, a minor child, to stay under state supervision without their parents being notified. The additional compelling reason was if they were seeking abortion or gender-affirming care services.
Again,
that's the exact intent, Sean.
Yeah, no, this is yet one more example of how the political left is trying to ram an extreme agenda down the throats of the most gullible people there are, children, particularly, teenage kids. And the response is keep the parents away from those kids. You see the same contempt for parents in some of the education curriculum. I'm not going to get sidetracked. Don't worry, Randy. But you see the same train of thinking about parents. Always viewing we don't need more parental input on education. Education, we need less. You see this kind of contempt for parents because, the left believes that families are a bourgeois institution and they get in the way of their ideology. And there's absolutely no doubt this is an ideologically driven agenda that's going on here. So I am so glad that you are highlighting Senate Bill 5599 for a big time no vote. We want all KVI listeners to hit the legislative hotline today, right now. And if it's busy, and chances are it will be in a few minutes, when you call, they just opened, just keep the number and call later today. Tell your House member, because it's already passed the Senate, so nothing we can do right now in the Senate. Tell your House members no on Senate Bill SB 5599. Respect parents' rights. In fact, just respect parents. No on SB 5599. Maybe the most radical bill in Olympia this session, Randy Pepl.
Absolutely, because it's just another attempt for the state to replace the parent, the state to be who the individual leans on. It's all part of that ideology, John.
And here's the phone number again. The legislative hotline is 800-562-6000. Again, that is 800-562-6000. Call your House members. And if you don't know their names, don't worry. The very kind, patient operators at the legislative hotline can tell you who your House members are. All you got to do is tell them where you live. And they can look it up in seconds. Tell your House members, both of them, everyone has two House members, no on SB 5599. Randy Pepl, thanks again for ringing the bell here on the John Carlson Show.
Thank you, John. Thanks for your listeners.
And check out shiftwa.org. Again, that's shiftwa.org. And call that hotline, 800-562-6000, no on anti-parents, SB 5599.
Bridge beyond the tweets. Talk radio 570 KVI.
Do you know all roads lead to Muckleshoot? I promised this last hour. This is an on this date in history that I find fascinating. It was Harry Truman, president on this date, 1947, issued an executive order that basically was the loyalty order, and it basically required federal employees to have complete and unswerving loyalty to the United States. And I saw that and I thought, huh, I wonder how an executive order like that would go over today if Joe Biden issued that. How many federal government employees, John, do you think would declare I am not pledging my complete and unswerving loyalty to the U.S. I just might be a communist.
Well, is it unreasonable? Is it unreasonable that you should be loyal to the country you're drawing a paycheck from? I don't know. I'm just thinking probably yes.
We've probably got some examples of people that would patently refuse that. So that struck me funny. On the socialists on social media, yesterday in Portland, they had a group called Mask Block, and not as into B-L-O-C-K and resist something or prevent something, but Block B-L-O-C, which is kind of like the black block, anti-capitalist,
yes.
Antifa. So it's Mask Block PDX. And they held a rally yesterday because they are sad that Oregon's public health has ended the mask wearing requirements. And so Mask Block PDX held a rally and basically said, it's rest in peace to public health in Oregon in loving memory. And they posted this on their Twitter feed. August 31st, 1854 to April 3rd, 2023. It's April 23rd when this particular mask requirement is going to end. And they say, join us in mourning the end of infection control in Oregon, calling on the governor and Oregon Health Administration to keep public health alive. And they invited people yesterday at this gathering at the Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland, their equivalent of the Westlake Center in Seattle.
Sure.
Dress in black, funeral attire, masks required, will have extras.
Text me from your KVI app, which is free and which you can load onto your phone so easy. Just go to your app store or if you have a Samsung and Android.
Android is what you're device. Looking for, but yeah.
Or Zach when we need him.
Well done, Tech Master.
Just Zach's go to the Play Store there and download the KVI app. There you go. Now you know why we need a guy like Zach.
No, I hear on my day off, I heard you guys and I emailed you. I heard you promoing the app and getting Zach on the air. I went, this is so perfect.
Yeah, all of us are like, Friday.
Come on, Zach. Come on, Zach, set me up with the app here. I want that KVI app.
So I downloaded the app on the air. You can do it within seconds. And there's some really nice little features on it there for you. Again, it's all free. So check it out on your Apple or Android device. Okay. You know, one of these days we're going to start a little contest. I know we already have our legendary song lyric contest that's very popular. But we're going to say, is this true or is this a joke?
Like fact or fiction sort of a thing?
Not just fact or fiction, but is this true or is this a joke?
Satire.
It's so ridiculous. It's a joke.
I'm with you now.
Or do we use the word fake? Because fake has been used so much. Fake news, fake social media.
Because yesterday we talked about the professor from Loyola University who wrote a serious post. Again, this is someone who's an associate professor. I assume she has tenure. Who wrote a serious post saying that women who keep a clean kitchen with a beautifully organized pantry and everything in its place, refrigerator and a spice rack where you can find exactly what you're looking for, those women are engaging in racism. And she actually had a term for it. She calls it pantry porn. You would think this was a joke. But no, there are people who think like that. They are so obsessed with race, they can't get it out of their head, that everything is seen through the lens of race. So unless you're a slob, you can assume that you're a racist, that a clean kitchen is seen as a sign of classist and racist roots when viewed through various social structures. Whenever you hear an academic use the term social structure, lefty, Marxist, stop listening. Okay. That's how far out they are when they start using the term social structure.
Yeah, some giveaways there, right?
It means book smart, street stupid. No reason to continue hearing what they have to say. So yesterday it was, if you keep a clean kitchen, you're racist. Today, it's drinking coffee perpetuates white supremacy. That a product that was supposedly created by black people for other black people is now a, quote, pillar of white supremacist capitalism, close quote. If you consume coffee, you are helping an industry built on racism. This is from a real live website. It's called Afru, A-F-R-U, afru.com. And, quote, we believe in the power of fashion to spark meaningful conversations on justice as well as the other way around. Afru is a black-led and majority black-owned startup that combines fashion and streetwear with lifestyle commentary to create a strong social justice brand that is relevant and attractive to folks. But here is just how immersed in extremism and paranoia they are. They start off this way. Every facet of the coffee industry is rooted in racism. From the moment the whites viciously stole coffee from black and brown people to the present day Karen sipping her morning cup of white supremacy, whites have been able to drink the fruits of our labor and our culture with impunity. And of course, they point out that coffee first came to North America and Europe between 1650 and 1700, and coffee beans were picked by enslaved people. I think most crops probably were back then. And they go on to say, the authors, that if you are drinking a cup of coffee, you're making a political statement. And not only that, it depends on what kind of coffee you're drinking, because all kinds of coffee are objectionable. Some are more objectionable than others. Quote, white supremacy is built into the foundation of the coffee industry. The global coffee economy was created through colonialism, the white supremacist system under which European countries invaded, subjugated, and exploited the countries of black and brown people. After Dutch spies stole coffee from Africa, Europeans forced black and indigenous people into slavery to grow it on colonized land. And they said, now that it's been established that historically coffee is deeply rooted in colonialism and racism, you might be wondering what the next steps are. In other words, because coffee beans were picked by slaves 350 years ago, you probably shouldn't be drinking it in 2023. But it gets more bizarre than that. Quote, if you think coffee culture can find refuge in specialty coffee, think again. The bourgeois notion of specialty coffee is explicitly rooted in classism, which is directly linked to racism. It's not just that black folks cannot afford specialty coffee, but the very acceptance of the term specialty coffee suggests that some coffee is somehow superior to other coffee, an idea that's rooted in whiteness. Now, that's interesting. If we accept the notion that some beer is better than others, that some whiskeys are better than others, that some...
I was going to say wine. They're clear examples of that.
Yes, you racist. So, you came up with a very good...
Classist, racist yes. person that I am considering
classist
wine.
Classist and racist.
Yeah.
Let's say athletes, drink refreshment drink.
Oh, yeah, like the rehydration stuff?
Yeah, rehydration mm-hmm. drinks. Mm-hmm. If you accept the notion that some are better than others, what is wrong with accepting that some coffee is better than others? But then, wait a second, what if you're African American and you just want to go to the corner coffee shop? Quote, hold on. This is from the essay. Hold on. The number one sign of gentrification of black spaces is a chic new coffee shop. According to Bitter Root magazine, Bitter says it well.
Just going to say.
These shops jumps right seem out. To sprout on the corner of every neighborhood just as it's beginning to gentrify, a phenomenon researchers are starting to notice too. And they say, never mind if it's described as an anti-capitalist coffee shop. Quote, despite their anarchist demagoguery, they're trying to exploit people of color just like the 19th century colonists.
All right. Finally got a demagoguery in there.
Here's another thing. Again, they have a solution. But before you get to the solution, they offer this nugget here. Unfortunately, coffee is not the only racist drink on the market. Milk also became racist after white supremacists began using the white drink as a symbol of their skin.
That was the reason it was used?
I
thought it was because it came out of the cow and was readily available.
Because it was available. Or out of the goat.
But then again.
Or whatever.
I'm not an agriculture scientist, so.
It says, but the whiteness of milk and milk's devastating effects on the beautiful black body make it almost as bad as coffee for some black people. These people are absolutely turned inside out with paranoia and with extremism.
Anything there on chocolate milk? For those of us that remember, we had choices in school and just looked at it.
Are you making a political statement?
Where does cocoa come from?
Yes,
near the equator. So again, that was all colonized and taken inappropriately.
But here's their solution. Ultimately, and I know this will hurt, a proper commitment to doing anti-racist direct action requires that we give up coffee altogether unless you're Ethiopian.
Got to be authentic, right? Keep it authentic.
You could just see all the white lefties saying, oh no, I want to act in solidarity, but I live in Seattle. I mean, what do I do?
Years ago, I traveled to Costa Rica. Costa Rica has very prominent coffee bean growing terrain. I don't know if that's where it originated, but is that now appropriation by Costa Ricans / Central Americans if coffee beans originated somewhere else, but this was just a place where they happened to grow very well?
Anyway, the reason I bring this up, yes, we can laugh at the silliness, we can laugh at the extremism, but please understand that in some circles, this is actually taken seriously. And the more removed you are from day-to-day ordinary life, like in academia or in some quarters of urban media, this nonsense will actually get traction. this is what happens when you live in a society that judges everything through the lens of race. Looking at everything through the lens of race, or for that matter, through the lens of gender, or through the lens of sexual orientation, or what have you, it will inevitably take you down hallways into hallways of extremism like this. It's just too bizarre for words. Welcome back to the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. I wanted to replay this clip from the CNN morning show that featured Kevin O'Leary, one of the stars of Shark Tank, the investment show. Where he is explaining, you know, good investments, bad investments, where he goes to make money, where he avoids. And he told Don Lemon, along with Poppy Harlow and Caitlin Collins, those are the three hosts of the morning show. We don't always get along, if you've seen it, that he doesn't do business in liberal, blue-run states. He uses an interesting term. He calls them uninvestable. Now, I know I played this clip for you yesterday, but I'm playing it for you again because there's a local angle here. Have a listen.
I don't put companies here in New York anymore, or in Massachusetts, or in New Jersey, or in California. Those states are uninvestable. The policy here is insane. The taxes are too high. We put them in Fargo, North Dakota, because 40% of the people work elsewhere, including Boston. So I was, you know, of a bit of a debate with Elizabeth Warren about this, but I say, look, Senator, we've got to move the companies out of your state because you're not investable anymore. You're punishing people if they're successful. You overtax them. You hit them with a super tax. New Jersey, what a mess. New York, uninvestable.
Wait, California. Why is New York uninvestable?
Try and do a project in New York. Try and build a data.
Yeah, I'm asking, Don's point is, beyond the taxes?
Oh, the regulatory environment is punitive. I had a project in upstate New York behind the grid in Niagara Falls for electricity, a global data center we were building. Eventually, it got so bad with the politicians in the local region and the state policy, we moved it to Norway and all the jobs. Norway has it now. Thousands of jobs coming out of that. I mean, that's New York, uninvestable. Sorry, don't shoot the messenger, just telling you the way it is.
Okay, so that is Kevin O'Leary kind of laying it on the line. Just say, when you have choices, you have choices. So there's a local angle here that I thought you'd find interesting. Because you say California, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, isn't Washington State really liberal too? Yeah. And we've got some of the same problems. The largest silicon metal plant outside of China is going to be not only built in the United States, but they were going to build the smelter right here in Washington State, not in population-heavy Western Washington, but in Northeast Washington, in the town of Newport, which is a nice town. I've been there, on the Ponderay River. It's not going to be built there anymore. This smelter actually got the approval of Jay Inslee, who declared it a project of statewide significance. A $150 million project would have employed 140 people. But they have picked up and moved it to Tennessee. It'll be on the Mississippi River now. Because of the, quote, thicket of permitting and zoning issues, along with opposition from local residents and environmental groups worried about emissions. In other words, the carbon footprint. Jason Timko, who's the CEO of Sunnova Global, said that the property had to be rezoned in a timely manner, but county officials said, oh, that no problem, we can get that done. Except it didn't get done. Mr. Timko said Ponderay County couldn't even get their comprehensive plan updated. When we bought the land south of Newport from the local utility district, it was earmarked by them for a gas turbine, so we thought it would be fine for us. The local community development director for Ponderay County said the comprehensive plan has taken a long time, said there's a lot of work to do by a consultant the county hired in the planning commission. And so basically, because of just what you heard Kevin O'Leary talk about, local and state, because a lot of these comprehensive plan compliance measures are state measures, because of local and state government, this wonderful new company, Sunnova Global, and the jobs that would have been located here are now being located in Tennessee, where the governor there participated in the groundbreaking at Tiptonville. Thought that you should know. We're not that far behind. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, wage growth in Washington is below the national average now. I bet you didn't think you'd hear that for a long time. After we hear about all these tech industry fueled jobs, direct and indirect, that have Washington as one of the leading wage centers in America, wage growth is actually below the national average now in Washington. King County's growth is below the state growth. And when you have the heavy hand, not just of taxation, but of regulation, it matters, because when it comes to government, time is not money. Time is not money. They don't care. Or let's put it this way. If they don't want to care, they don't have to, because time doesn't cost government anything. It definitely costs businesses. You're listening to The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI Seattle, KPLZ HD3 Seattle. It's all the time we have this morning on this 21st day of March, the month already two-thirds over. Get ready for Ari Hoffman, 3 to 6, Lars Larson, noon to 3. And right now it's time for Markley, Van Camp, and Robbins.